Good morning, Dr. Ross. I trust you are well on this Saturday morning.
Brent, I'm extremely well and lovely to talk to you, mate.
As always, we start with some listener questions. Arthur says, Dr. Walker, I live in Coffs Harbour. I have been to every chemist in town and none of them have the two medications you spoke about for reflux, that is Tarzac and Nizac. What was the third medication you mentioned last week?
Yeah, the third one was famotidine, F-A-M-O-T-I-D-I-N-E. And again, I'm surprised about this. This is a few times I've heard this, but I've not had any problems with my patients getting it. So I'm not sure what the problem is. If any pharmacists are listening, please ring in and let us know if there is a problem around Australia, because I'm not aware that there is.
Spell that again for me, Ross.
F-A-M-O-T-I-D-I-N-E. Famotidine.
Famotidine. Thank you very much.
They're all very similar drugs.
Belinda says, I'm always offered a generic brand of medication when I present my scripts at the chemist. They are cheaper. What's your advice on the generic medications when comparing them to the non-generic medications?
Yeah, look, the only real difference is there may be different fillers in the generics as opposed to the original brand. And it doesn't mean they're any worse or any better. It's just some people do well with one brand but don't do well with the other one. It has exactly the same amount of active ingredient, but they use fillers and different preservatives and colourings for different pills. And so, yeah, I have had situations where some people said, oh, doctor, I felt great on this one, but when I switched to this brand, I felt sick and it did my stomach in. So, and you've always got to ask your chemist, say, for example, if you're lactose intolerant, often a lot of these different pharmaceuticals have a bit of lactose in them. So, for example, there's a group of drugs that you use for blood thinning. Very strong blood thinners that have really replaced warfarin to a great extent. Drugs like Eliquis, Xarelto, and Pradaxa. Now, Eliquis and Xarelto have a lactose base. So I saw a woman yesterday, for example, who is lactose intolerant, and I prescribed Xarelto for her, not realizing there was lactose in it, and it really upset her gut. So I checked with the chemist. Yes, there was lactose in it. The only one that doesn't have lactose is Pradaxa. Now, Pradaxa is, again, a very good blood thinner, but 10% of people who take Pradaxa get reflux. So, unfortunately, in life, there is no free lunch. I line up 100 people, give them all the same medication, whether it be generic or non-generic, and about 10% of people get side effects, possibly from the active ingredient or possibly from the fillers.
Are these non-generic medications made by the same companies?
Typically, no, but sometimes, yes. So, for example, for some company might also be bidding against themselves, so to speak, because sometimes they make a generic medication for people who can't afford their major one. And so people think, oh, I'm getting a cheaper generic from another company, and they're just getting it from the same company. But a lot of the generics are made, say, for example, in India. Now, that doesn't mean people shouldn't take them, because now there's now a lot of high-quality stuff made in India and China. So everyone thinks, oh, stuff from those countries are dodgy. Yeah, possibly 20 years ago, but certainly not now.
Ron, as I'm a little overweight, but even when I wasn't, I still had this problem. I seemed to always sweat in the groin area, even when sitting down. Is this normal, and can you use deodorants in that area?
Well, is it normal? The answer is it's a variant of normal. It's not a disease, so if he's been to the doctor and the doctor's checked him out for different things, maybe checking out his thyroid, other male hormones. So, for example, I don't know if Ron said how old he is, but when we all hit 50 and the hormones go south, which they do for men and women, a lot of men lose their testosterone levels. And when you lose your testosterone levels, you can sweat in different places, including in the groin. Some people just have a lot of sweat glands in the groin. And it's, as I said, it's not a disease, it's a variant. It's like having a big nose. A big nose is not a disease. It's just a variant on normal. So it's the sort of thing where, yes, if it's troubling him, he should have a checkup with his doctor, have some tests run, but typically the tests will all be normal.
Michael's question, are statins effective in controlling cholesterol?
Of course they are. Now, look, statins do their job, and the job is to lower cholesterol. But that doesn't mean they're not harmless. And it all does. It also doesn't mean that if your cholesterol is elevated, you automatically need to go on a statin. And see, this is the ridiculous knee-jerk reaction of some of my colleagues. Oh, high cholesterol, you must be on a statin because I've got to lower your cholesterol because if I don't, you'll have a heart attack. That is just abject nonsense. The question isn't, doctor, how can I lower my cholesterol? The question is my cholesterol and all of its mates spilling into my arteries to set up fatty plaques? And that's what the coronary calcium score tells you. So if your coronary calcium score, say, for example, anyone between the ages of about 50 up to 65, if your coronary calcium score is well below 100, you do not need a statin. You don't need to lower your cholesterol. But if you give statins to almost everyone, they will almost always lower cholesterol. But the big question is whether you really need to do that in the first place. And the only time you need to do it is, A, if someone already has established heart disease, they've already had a heart attack, stent or a bypass, or B, on a coronary calcium score, there is evidence of significant coronary atherosclerosis, which typically means the calcium score is well above 100. But if you're a 70-year-old male, the average calcium score for a 70-year-old male is 200 or above, and I do not treat cholesterol in, say, a 70-year-old who's got a coronary calcium score of 150 because they're below average and they're at much less risk than someone who has a much higher score at that age.
Sally wants to know, why can't you name the products you recommend? She said, I know it's not your fault, but it seems extremely stupid.
Oh, look, let me give you my perspective on this. Would you prefer a doctor who understands the product, understands how it works, to be the person to endorse the product, whether or not they're being paid for it? And if the doctor just declares, yes, I'm a consultant for the company, I do get some fees for talking about the benefits. So would you prefer that doctor who understands it to come out and say, yes, I believe we should be taking product X? Or would you prefer a celebrity or a sportsman whose only understanding of how the product works is how quickly the ink dries on the contract? So I think it's ridiculous, but I don't make the rules. And the rules from the TGA are that if a doctor then endorses a particular product, then that doctor is possibly earning money from endorsing that product, and therefore the doctor or the health professional should not be allowed to do it. That's the argument. Some people say that's reasonable. Other people think it's ridiculous, and I personally think it's ridiculous. But again, people can say, oh, you're only doing that because you're getting money out of it. What doctors can do or health professionals can do in this situation is talk about the ingredients, but not specifically name the product. So, for example, I have a strong association with a company that makes the bergamot products, but I can't particularly name the actual product that they're making because there are other bergamot products on the market. But the bergamot product that I talk about is the much stronger version that's only grown in Calabria, as opposed to bergamot oranges that are sourced somewhere else that don't have any science behind them because there's been no studies done on that particular product. So it's a significant discussion. Some people say, no, doctors should keep well away from it, and I accept their argument there. Other people say, gee, I'd prefer to know that the doctor believes in the product, takes it himself or herself, and is happy to endorse it, but I don't make the rules.
Edward wants to know, Ross, why do different people react to mosquito bites differently? Edward says, I'm really affected by them, and of course, it's starting to be that time of the year where the mosquitoes come out.
Look, I'm with Edward. Mosquitoes absolutely love me, and I think mosquitoes are one of God's great mistakes. I can't stand the things, and I hate mosquito bites, and I hate mosquitoes. And I'm not sure why some people are more prone to it, but he's correct. Some people just have pheromones that they secrete or something that attracts mosquitoes. Maybe their skin's warmer, and the mosquitoes are more attracted to them than they are to other people. I don't know the reason. No one really knows. But it certainly does happen.
Last question, then we'll get stuck into some of the topics, and it's from Joanne. Joanne says, why does magnesium make me go to the toilet?
Ah, very good question. And it's a bit like the theme of what we've been talking about today. Everyone's different. Now, about 10% of people who take magnesium, the magnesium stimulates the bowel and can give you more diarrhea. And I remember a patient I saw probably about 10 years ago, who I'd put her on magnesium to try and calm her heart down. because she was getting very irregular heartbeats. And so the and in fact, I spoke to a person yesterday in my practice who I'd put on to a combination of magnesium and krill oil, an omega-3, because she was getting a lot of irregular heartbeats. And going under these therapies has really settled the heart down. She's now feeling great. But then this particular woman I saw 10 years ago, who I gave the magnesium to, she didn't come back to see me. I mentioned the potential for magnesium irritating her bowel, and she forgot about it. And then she started to get diarrhea. And she went off and saw gastroenterologists who didn't even ask her about the magnesium. And I'm not saying all gastroenterologists don't do that, but this particular gastroenterologist didn't. Did colonoscopies on her, couldn't find anything wrong with her, and said, I don't know why you're getting diarrhea, gave her anti-diarrheal agents. And then eventually she came back to see me. I said, how you been? Oh, I've had all sorts of trouble with my bowel doctor. I said, what's the magnesium? I told you about it.
Different strokes for different people. You can't say blokes these days. It's a bit woke, Ross.
Oh no, you definitely can't say that. Oh, gee.
We've talked about AFib, atrial fibrillation, before. One of the topics today, it's estimated to be worse than what it was first thought. In fact, it's estimated to be three times more common than previously thought.
Yeah, and here's one of the problems. This is a study that was done in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. They, when they looked at a huge population in the US, they found that, as you say, that atrial fibrillation was much more common than people suspected. And why is that important? Because, and I say all the time, 1% of people up to the age of 50 have had a clinical episode of atrial fibrillation. Now, what is atrial fibrillation? You've got two chambers at the top of the heart called the atria, two at the bottom called the ventricles. Now, the ventricle, and especially the left ventricle, is the major pumping chamber, but the atria are really the holding chambers. And they're thin-walled, and they've got to pump into the thick ventricles. And after a while, they say, look, I just can't keep doing this anymore, and start to quiver. That's the fibrillation. So the bottom chambers go all over the place. Now, as we all get older, so if I monitored your heart or my heart for a week, Brent, we'd see little runs of atrial fibrillation. That's just the electrics wearing out as you get older. But a clinical episode is when that fibrillation stays there for a few minutes to a half an hour to maybe until you get to see a doctor who gets you back in a good rhythm. So as I said, 1% of people up to age 50, 5% 60, 10% 70, 20% 80. If we're all up to 150, we'd all be fibrillating because those top chambers would have worn out. So it's, why is that important? It's important because if you have atrial fibrillation, especially if it's not treated, you have double the death risk compared with people who don't have atrial fibrillation. Atrial fibrillation is a third of the cause of stroke, markedly increases your risk for heart failure, heart attack, chronic kidney disease, and dementia. So it's the sort of thing that should be picked up early, treated early, and you can prevent all those things from happening. And also the important thing is now, we're getting these wearables where some of these smart watches, you can wear them. They don't tell you you're fibrillating if you don't look, but you could check your heart for 30 seconds every day, and it doesn't, everyone can do that, and see if you're in a normal rhythm or to see whether you're having fibrillation. Because one of the things that irritates me as a cardiologist is that probably 20 to 30% of people who get fibrillation don't even know they have it. And some people go into fibrillation and the GP says, oh, you better go and see the cardiologist. They refer them off to me. My waiting time is months. And by the time they get in to see me, they've been in fibrillation for 6 to 12 months, and it's almost impossible to get them out of fibrillation. So I say to all my patients, if you think you've gone into fibrillation, you ring my office, I'll get you in today and do something about it.
I was interested to hear you say about these devices, because I have an Apple smartwatch. And there is an app on that allows you to actually hold your finger on the crown for 30 seconds and it comes back and tells you either you do or you don't have it. Are they accurate?
Absolutely. Let me tell you a personal story. I had an Apple Watch. I don't have one anymore, but I had an Apple Watch a few years ago, and I was on a plane from Sydney to Bangkok, and I got the call, is there a doctor on board? And I put my hand up, and I went down to see this fellow who was holding his chest, feeling dreadful. I took off my watch, put it onto his wrist, got an ECG done on him, sitting there in the plane, and could read the ECG off the watch. It was sent to my phone, so I got a good look at the ECG. could make a diagnosis based on what I was seeing on the ECG, was able to not have to divert the plane. There were some emergency medications on the plane that I gave him. Within 15 minutes, he was back to normal.
I'm okay. This ECG does not show signs of atrial fibrillation.
Excellent.
Hopefully, we'll be able to talk again next week.
Yeah, I think we'll be fine.
Researchers have unveiled a cutting-edge non-invasive technique that can predict chronic high blood pressure with a degree of accuracy using just a person's voice.
Yeah. Look, I thought this was really bizarre. They basically, and I put this in my weird file, they basically had took 245 people, got them to record their voices up to six times a day for 2 weeks. Just by normal speaking, this mobile phone app was able to detect the accuracy for high blood pressure, 84% females, 77% for males. Now you think, how on earth can someone's voice tell you about blood pressure? I don't know, but they just said it was basically because of the variability in pitch, the patterns in speech, the energy distribution, the sharpness of the sound can be linked to high blood pressure. And well over 25% of the global population has a degree of high blood pressure. I just thought it was a really weird thing.
What else are they testing with voice recognition? Of course, this all comes on the back of the AI, artificial intelligence.
Well, things like, they're looking for a whole lot of neurologic conditions, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease. And I mean, with blood pressure, maybe there'll be a thing that affects your sugar. I don't know. It's going to come to the point where we'll have wearables for almost everything, because they've even now got a wearable lung patch that tells you how bad you're wheezing and your chronic lung disease is.
It's a great segue, because that's one of the topics today. Let's talk about that, this wearable lung patch. What's that all about?
Well, they took 52 patients in an outpatient asthma clinic, and they basically put this patch on their chest and got them to breathe deeply for 30 seconds, and the patch actually assessed how bad the wheezing was. And you see, this is the problem with asthma and chronic lung disease. Many people with these conditions aren't monitoring their lungs enough, so that there's a marked increase in attendance at accident emergencies and the need for further acute therapies. So if you can pick up somebody's degree of wheeze and lung function early, you can get in and treat them and stop them ending up in hospitals very sick. So just exciting stuff that's happening in the, shall we say, the wearable space.
Now, you wrote an interesting article about living to 100, predicting who's going to live to 100. And there's some studies that show that it actually may be possible for more than just the odd person to live to 100.
Yeah, this was a study published in a journal called Geroscience out of Sweden. There's a great place in Sweden that I've actually been to called the Karolinska Institute. And this is one of the great research centres around the world. They took 44,000 Swedes who were evaluated between 1985 to 1996, average age 64 up to, not average age, but age between 64 to 99. And they found that of these 44,000, a pretty considerable 1,224 lived to 100. So they thought, well, why? One of the first things they found out, my friend, and it's, you may have heard me mention this once or twice, there's a thing called lifestyle, the five keys of being healthy, having no addictions, good quality sleep, good quality eating and less of it, 3 to 5 hours every week of moderate exertion, and most importantly, happiness. And so people who practiced those five keys were certainly amongst those who lived well to the age of 100. But then they also looked at what we call biomarkers, and they found, interestingly, there were two very commonly measured biomarkers that weren't linked to reaching 100. One was your total cholesterol level, and the other one were your total iron levels. But the important biomarkers that were linked to living to 100 were how good your kidney function was. So if you've got poor kidney function, poor liver function, an elevated uric acid, and an elevated blood sugar, because we know the problems with blood sugar leading to diabetes, and there's hardly any diabetics who live to 100. Unless they want to start reversing their diabetes. So really, living to 100, yes, of course, pick the right relatives as well, but it's how you look after yourself. And I often talk about the blue zones where they have enormous longevity. When people who live in the blue zones then go and live somewhere else, they take on the longevity of where they move to. So So it's not as if it's particularly genetic. It's certainly environmental. And you look at a study called the Morgan Trial. People who are the best at practicing the five keys of being healthy had an 83% reduction in cardiovascular disease. Another trial called the Million Veterans Study out of the US showed that people who practice those five keys, and sadly, Brent, that's less than 10% of the population, but people who did practice those five keys from age 40 added 24 extra years to their life. And if you think then the average age of death for a woman is 80 and for a male is 84, sorry, the other way around, 80 for a male, 84 for a female, adding another 24 years to that is pretty significant longevity.
You mentioned about having the right relatives and genetics. Interesting quick question before I let you go. If you've got a mum that lived to be nearly 90, but your dad died at 77, how do you end up working out whose genetics you've got?
You can't. You can't. Look, mate, I've got families where there might be five siblings, three have vicious heart disease, and two have nothing. Now, they all came from the same oven and the same sperm donor. But the issue is, and this is where people don't get genetics. They think genetics are, dad had it, therefore I'm going to have it, or my parents didn't have it, therefore I won't get it. And that's complete nonsense. Because who you are, unless you've got an identical twin brother, which I think you don't have, there is no one else on this planet who has exactly the same genetics as you. And we're all made up of somewhere between 20 to 25,000 genes, and every gene is paired because you get one from mum, one from dad. So if you think about it then, every gene, there's only three possibilities. Two good genes, a good and a bad gene, or two dodgy genes. So for example, in cardiovascular disease, we've already mapped around 300 genes for heart disease. So if you've inherited 200 out of the 300 dodgy genes for heart disease, you're going to get heart disease in your 40s, 50s, or 60s. Whereas if you've only inherited, say, 20 to 30 to 50, you probably won't get heart disease. So in each family, it's just the coin toss of each individual gene that codes for particular diseases. So every disease is genetic, but your genes loads the gun, then your environment pulls the trigger.
With that, I will let you go. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks for answering those listener questions, as always. And we do say, if you've got a question for Dr. Ross, send it to us via email and we'll put it to the good doctor when we catch up with him next week. Thanks again, Ross.
Talk to you then, mate.
Look forward to it. Bye-bye.